Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. Today is the first quarter 2022 wrap-up, equity overview, and Rambus chartology. Our quarterly wrap-ups have four segments, and this is the third. 2 weeks from now, we will do the theme, Special Acquisition Corporation SPACs. Today, I'm going to talk about what's been happening in the financial markets with a focus on the equity markets. There are four areas I want to discuss. One is a brief review of recent materials and links that you can find at the Solera Report that are very good background. To a certain extent, the equity overview when it comes to sort of personal planning and process, I say the same thing repeatedly. And so I'd much rather you go back and listen to the last 4 to 6 equity overviews, particularly the annual equity overview that we just did in January. Then I'm going to go through the financial charts. Then I want to talk about 8 noteworthy developments, which I think are worth your being aware of. And then I want to cover a review of allocations using, as example, my allocations. So let's start with recent materials and links. You'll find subscriber links on the commentary for this segment of the wrap-up for the equity overview and Rambus chartology. And of course, we also have a wrap-up web presentation. It's how we build the material throughout the production of the wrap-up. And you can find the links in the commentary, and then the financial charts and Rambus chartology and other charts are going to be at the web presentation, which you can link to from the commentary. A lot of links. I think we have 23. Let's look at the useful material, which supplements this equity overview. As I said, first, they're the last 4 to 6 equity overviews, and particularly the annual equity overview that we did in January. I went through the process of financial planning and allocations, financial allocations, in an economic warfare scenario. So, you know, this is a war, and this is not just about financial planning. It's about war planning. I also want to recommend you listen to a special report that I did not that long ago with Ulrich Groniger, the host of our Solera Science series. It was called Control and Freedom Happens One Person at a Time. And one of the things I realized as I talk about the financial control grid that's literally being built around us and in our homes and in our cars and literally now with the injections perhaps in our body. A lot of people just don't see that control grid now as it's building. And it's really important you do this because one of the keys to financial security, if it exists, is to get that control grid out of your body, out of your mind, out of your home, out of your life, out of your community, and do everything you can to protect yourself from it. So it's very important to me that you see it. We also did several equity overviews back, a big link collection that was a response to many of the questions that I get both in the equity overview and Ask Catherine. And so we created this sort of mega link collection, and I would encourage you to go through those links in connection with going through the old equity or the past equity overviews. I think it'll be helpful. This month, we mailed our taxation wrap-up to all the print subscribers. It'll go up at the store shortly. So if you're not a print plus digital subscriber, if you're a digital subscriber but would like to get it, you can get it at the store. The taxation wrap-up looks at an issue. It's based on a U.S.-centric case, but it applies to any of the G7 and industrialized nations. We are financing a criminal enterprise and with our taxes, and the question is, what do we do about it? It's not a simple or easy thing, but it's a doorway we're all going to have to walk through, so I would encourage you to take a look at that. Finally, again, we have a wrap-up presentation. The way we do these wrap-ups, as you know, is we build them over 4 or 5 segments, and we build out the web presentation, and then when it's finally finished, we convert it into the PDF magazine and then also print that PDF. So check out all those links. Again, they'll be in the subscriber links in the commentary for this equity overview. So let's turn to the charts. If you do a search for equity overview on the website, at the homepage, you can pick up all the equity overviews As I said, the most important is to listen to the one we did in January, the annual wrap-up equity overview. Control and freedom happen one person at a time with Ulrich and Catherine. I strongly recommend you listen to that if you haven't. Then the mega collection of subscriber links. That was from the first quarter 2021 wrap-up. And again, in response to many of the questions that we get at Ask Catherine or the equity overview, U.S. taxation with or without representation is up at the wrap-up presentation. And at the top here of the website, you can get the PDF copy. It's right here. But you can also get the hard copy if it's not mailed to you automatically. The international was mailed 2 weeks ago. The U.S. printer takes a little bit more time. And those started mailing several days ago and should be out mailing all week. So if you don't have yours, you should have it hopefully shortly. And here's a look at the web presentation that you can link to from the commentary at the equity overview. And as I said, our theme is on special acquisition corporations, SPACs, investment craze or reset laundry. It is a fascinating and very intriguing topic, and I think a very important part of the going direct reset. So I can't wait to share that with you with attorney Carolyn Betts in 2 weeks. Okay, so as I said, let's turn to the charts. Before we look at the charts, I just want to give you an overview. I put up the Securities Industry Capital Markets Factbook for 2021. It was published in July 2021. And it basically has overview and stats on the different financial markets. And it's sort of good to see things in perspective. In 2014, I said that rather than a collapse, Mr. Global was going to mark up the equity. So think of the planet as a house, and it has debt, the mortgage, it has equity, the ownership, it has the asset. And if you're underwater and your house is worth less than your mortgage, you know, there are two things you can do. You can do something that makes the equity go up, or you can mark the debt down. And I said what Mr. Global was going to do is mark the equity up. And sure enough, at that time, the equity markets were about half what the global bond market is today. The global bond markets are $123.5 trillion as of 2020. The global equity market capitalization is $105.8. So the equity markets are on their way to being almost the same, or really the same size as the bond markets. To give you a sense of relative size, and I'll talk about this later when we talk about some of the latest developments. The total crypto market is $1.7 trillion. So, you know, think of the bond market as 100 times bigger. And Bitcoin is $750 billion. So a little bit less than half of the outstanding crypto. So crypto is still a very, very, in relative terms, tiny market, but growing. Then So let's turn to fixed income. If you go to the web presentation and click on fixed income, as soon as we fix it, it'll say financial markets, and then there'll be a drop down. But the first is fixed income. It updates from the first quarter. And as you can see, the US dollar was relatively strong. And but as interest rates started to sneak up, bonds started heading down. And of course, that got much more severe in March and now April. And just as I was leaving my desk to record this in the studio, lo and behold, it came in. The Fed raised the Fed funds rate 50 basis points today. So it's going to go higher. And what that means is that, as we've said many times before, the bull market in bonds, 40-year bull market in bonds is over. And that is a big, big change. Big, big change. One of the things I keep noting is that the typical portfolio that many advisors would recommend, it's a combination of bonds and stocks. The idea being when stocks fall, bonds will protect the value of the portfolio. That's not happening. Bonds are falling faster than stocks. And that's one of the problems of investing in an environment that is considered to be stagflation. So let's turn to sort of the credit issue. So we're looking at the charts and bonds, but I just wanted to bring up several charts. There's a website called the U.S. Debt Clock that tracks the outstanding debt. So this is the official debt of the U.S. government in the Treasury market. It amounts to $91,000 per citizen. What I will tell you is the $21 trillion that we know has disappeared works out to $65,000. So if that money was ever recaptured and brought back, that number would drop dramatically. Over here on the bottom right, you show the unfunded liabilities, which includes all the retirement benefits and healthcare, et cetera. One of the reasons you see such kooky things going on in the healthcare area is the future Medicare and Medicaid liabilities are phenomenal because we have a ridiculously expensive and, a healthcare system that is designed to do many things, but none of it has to do with making people healthy, in my opinion, at this point. At the U.S. Debt Clock, you can link to the World Debt Clock and take a look. One of the challenges of the bond market right now is we see across the board a deterioration in almost every sovereign credit around the world. And that's part of what the challenge in this environment, particularly countries that have borrowed in dollars and now cannot, are going to struggle to earn the dollars to pay them back when things are strong. On Money and Markets this week, the theme was step into the dollar bear trap, and that's exactly what's happening. This kind of strong dollar ultimately is not good for the United States, and is resulting in a drop in the percentage of the global reserves that are held in dollars. And part of the tension we're seeing is fossil fuel and commodities providers not wanting to trade commodities that are going up in value for fiat currency that's going down in value, whether it's the dollar or the euro. Okay, so bottom line, when you look at the sort of fixed income markets, one of the things you're watching is a serious deterioration in the credit quality in debt. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, I prefer to stay in hedged equities than to be in debt. You have to be very, very careful about your credits. Okay, we all know that the United States started putting very draconian sanctions on the Russians. As a result, we'd been seeing steady buying by the central banks in gold, building their reserves, particularly in the BRIC nations. But I expect that to continue to increase. Central bank gold demand did increase in Q1, but I think it was not as much as it was last year, and I think it's going to continue to increase steadily here on out. But you can get reports on sort of what the trends are at the World Gold Council. I just wanted to show you that link. Commodities are the spectacular story. We see just year to date, the commodities index is up 31% compared to the S&P that's down, over 12% the last time I looked. And once these interest rates from the Fed get cycled in, it's going to be worse. So we see in the first quarter, Russia relatively strong thanks to oil. And of course, after the first quarter was over, we know the sanctions went on. And in the United States, basically things, were no longer able to trade. I went in a brokerage account and just bought a tiny amount of RSX, which is the Russian ETF, just to see whether they would allow it to trade. I was trying to figure out what the real rules were. And the only way to do it was to buy some and see what happened. And of course, it's now frozen. I've had subscribers or colleagues who basically are trying to figure out how to trade and donate their Russian stocks to friends and colleagues in Russia since they are frozen and can't trade and in some cases have to get them out of their account. Gold and silver looked reasonably good. And I think gold and silver, the long-term trend is very positive, if not better than positive. The miners have a tough time. They have to go deeper and further to get less silver and gold. But if silver and gold continues to do as well as I think it will, I think the miners will certainly go with them. And finally, our old inflation chart It's a really important chart. If you look at this is as of the end of the first quarter, but if you look at this chart, and I'll show you an update shortly, a very big change is the VIX going up. So we've lived with with risk being taken out of the market as a practical matter for many investors by the what I call the Fed put. The Fed just bails everybody out. That scenario is over because the Fed is raising interest rates, and part of that is it's going to protect the value of the dollar. If there's complaints from people who don't want to hold the dollar, it's going to protect the value of the dollar internationally. To hell with the domestic market. Okay, so commodities is strong and expected to rise. Real assets matter. Okay, so I wanted to just look at selected market charts. Okay, so these were charts I used in Money and Markets this week. They're dated as of May 3rd. So I'm recording on May 4th, which means the interest rates are higher. So as you can see, unbelievably, this chart is from 1968. So it's a long-term dollar, US dollar index chart. And as you can see, we've had a very strong rise. It's probably going to get stronger. So 100 has been kind of a ceiling. We're shooting through to 103, and that means a lot of countries that have borrowed in the dollar but are going to have a harder time with sort of stagflation, getting dollars and earning dollars to pay, are going to be in real trouble. And we've already seen that. We've talked about Sri Lanka and some of the other countries that are sitting there deciding whether they pay their creditors or buy food as the price of food skyrockets. Two charts, we just show the US dollar against the euro and the Russian ruble against the euro. The ruble performing very, very strongly. As you can see, it took quite a nosedive when the sanctions started, but it's come back up as more and more European purchasers of gas and oil agree to, pay into the Gazprom bank, which converts it into rubles so it can't be seized. I would say what you can see is the US dollar improving strongly against the euro. And if anybody's been hurt by this process in the Ukraine war so far, it's the Europeans. Two charts on the interest rates. This is the 30-year interest rate. And again, this is going to be much higher. Expect this to be much higher, a week from now if it digests what happens to the Fed. The next charts show the CRB, the commodities index vis-a-vis the S&P. And you see this, I'm sorry, it's not the S&P, it's the Vanguard total stock market. So it's the total global stock market versus the commodities index. And what you can see is commodity index is up 31%, total global stock market down between 10 and 15%, and a real divergence between real assets and the equity market. Now, what's interesting is if you look within the equity market, there's plenty of commodities reflected in the value of certain equities, and you're watching a real shift internally. So the oil and gas stocks are flying, and it's the momentum growth stocks and social media technology that are getting slaughtered. Okay, then here's the 10-year Treasury interest rate, same looking chart as the 30-year. And then finally, I wanted to just show sort of what interest rates have done. So you're seeing the three things. You're seeing the S&P in the middle, down 12 plus percent for the year. You're seeing TLT, which is the long treasury, down much more. So again, bonds not providing support to the portfolio. So this means a typical 40-60 bond stock portfolio is getting hammered. In many cases, the bond's getting hammered even worse than the stocks, depending on what kind of stocks you're in. I wanted to take a look at real estate, which has been a relatively good performer. This is one of the real estate ETFs for the S&P. And of course, they're getting absolutely clonked ultimately by interest rates. And here's the the inflation chart we show every most money in markets. And as you can see, as I said, natural gas, heating oil, gasoline, it's the fossil fuels that are performing as energy becomes expensive. But look at this, the VIX is way in the positive territory. And this is a tremendous change of paradigm for many, many investors. And you know, many investors have lived their whole career now in a world where the Fed put protects them. And now they're going into a world where that certainly isn't happening and can, I think, can be expected to not happen for quite some time. So they're going into an unbelievably different environment. Anyway, so commodities, you know, we're in what some people would say is a commodity super cycle has probably begun. So those are sort of seven recent charts relative to what happened since the end of the quarter. And the bottom line is interest rates up, inflation up, and everything but real assets or something that can. Okay, let me. Okay, so then let's turn to the Rambus chartology, Rambus blockbuster chartology. Rambus is a technical analyst. I love his work. He produces a chartology for us once a quarter. I find this to be one of the most valuable things I use to cover the markets. I keep getting questions from people who, when they look at Rambus, say, if the markets are rigged, is this data meaningful? My answer is absolutely. First of all, every price on the planet is rigged with rare exceptions. So, so the question is, if we had true markets, would the price data be more valuable? Yes, it would be more valuable. But the reality is most pricing data of the kind that we're looking at in these charts show where people could buy and sell at that price. Liquidity and transactions were happening, which means it reflects what really did happen. And so as a mapping of what the rigged, you know, of what the politics were and who had what cost of capital and how relative values worked, tells you a tremendous amount about, tells you as much about a political economy as it does about a market economy. And I find it to be absolutely invaluable because these charts compress an enormous amount of pricing data into one simple picture where you can digest enormous, you know, to digest that data and that understanding and that analysis in text would take, you know, it would take 13 volumes. Anyway, so I find it as a compression technique to communicate where we've been and what happened to be invaluable. And I can listen to a group of pundits talk about what's happening and not understand. But as soon as I look at the pricing charts of what's happening, okay, now I understand what's going on. So for someone like me, it's a way of getting a picture of what's been going on in our world that is absolutely invaluable. Okay, so what does Rambus say? This is a most unusual Rambus presentation. I just want to read you a few of things that he says, because what he's describing is a paradigm shift in the markets. The long-term bull market in bonds is over. That's clear. The credit deterioration is going to result in some phenomenal change. The value of real assets is going up, and part of the shift to a potential multipolar world is the commodity producers exercising their political strength. That's what we see with Russia, and that's what we see with Saudi Arabia and the oil producers. So we have a whole world of people who've grown up where the VIX is low or negative, and they haven't functioned in a world of risk. You know, when you're in a bull market, the trend is your friend, and you don't have to worry about credit, and you don't have to worry whether the numbers in that company, you know, are real or not, because the trend will oftentimes pull you out. That's not the case in a situation where it's harder to earn a dollar, it's harder to borrow a dollar, and real risk matters. So let me just read you a couple of his comments. There are just a few times in one's investing career, depending on how early you start and if you survive long enough, that you are witness to some extraordinary changes from the macro scale perspective. A few examples would be the beginning of the 1929 crash, the end of the secular bull market that was made in 2000 that began in 1974, the 1987 crash, which is still the biggest one-day percentage drop in stock market history of 23%. I'll never forget that because a week before, I did everything I could to get my 401k out of equities, and they said they wouldn't let me until the end of the quarter. Bam! And then it gets smashed. I was so furious. Then there was the banking and housing bubble that collapsed into the 2009 crash low, which launched our current secular bull market in the stock markets, which is now 13 years old. And he goes on, but he talks about what a rare thing it is to be in a situation where you're in such an enormous turn. Part of the reason it's such an amazing event is because we tend to assume conditions are the way they are because it's perfectly natural. And we don't understand they're a result of interest rates coming down and everybody's cost of capital get cheaper and cheaper. It's like having the wind in your sails and you've forgotten what it's like to sail into headwinds all the time, every day. Because dropping interest rates lowers certain people's cost of capital. Rising interest rates raises pretty much everybody's cost of capital. Now, if you look at the average American, they pay 17% on a credit card, but the banks have been paying 0%. If you just look at the financial institution funding costs over the last month, they've risen dramatically. One of the things Rambis talks about in his introduction, and it's worth reading, is how important it is that we adjust to this change quickly. Let me see if I can find the way he said it. In the 1960s came the birth control pill that changed dramatically the birth rate for the next generation, the millennials. Now that the baby boomers are retiring in mass numbers, there are not enough workers to fill all the empty positions from the white collar to blue collar jobs. Employees now have the leverage to ask for higher wage, which employers will have to do to keep their workforce intact. Don't be surprised to see the immigrant population also rising in the years ahead to help fill many of the open positions. So he's talking about some of the dramatic changes. Then he says China is in big trouble because of its one-child policy in the 1990s. They have one of the fastest aging population on the planet and will be in much worse shape than the U.S. The aging demographics of the entire world, for the most part, is going to help fuel inflation in the future. He goes into some of the problems that are going to sort of drive inflation. It's a very good list and worth looking at. I also think that things like pandemics can engineer offsetting deflation, and I think that's part of the reason the people at the top are trying to engineer a control grid is to help us deal with this, help themselves deal with the situation, and protect and make sure that they are resource rich and are free to live, you know, 145 years, if that's what biotechs allows, without sharing it with everybody else. Anyway, we did a pension fund study about 5 or 6 years ago, and I think it was 2017. And one of the things we realized was at that point, the Americans had, despite having, you know, one third of the population or 25% of the population, 1.3 billion to 325 million. America had a multiple of 25 times as much retirement savings for their elderly. And despite the financial coup, it's still, you know, China's ability to handle its aging population is going to be, it's going to be tough. Anyway, let's look at what some of the things Rambis says that are important. One, he continues, as do I, to believe that the equity markets are going to remain strong. Now, we could have some horrible downs. We're in a correction now. I doubt we're turning to a bear. I don't see any sign of a bear. You know, we could get some very big corrections. And if things fall apart, which could be for us a much better scenario, you could see the equity markets drop dramatically and in fact, go into a bear. There would have to be quite a lot of consolidation. Anyway, but the case for bull market inequities is there. One of the things he talks about is, of course, this big swing in interest rates. And he has a chart I wanted you to see, 200 years of interest rates. This will help you understand what a profound change it is. So the bull market tracks when Volcker became head of the Fed to protect the dollar on the international markets and protect the commodities producers from getting debased. They give us oil, they get dollars. If the dollars sit around and drop in value, then they get irritated. And so to protect the dollar internationally and some other things, there's a lot of economic and warfare in this, Volcker sent interest rates through the roof. Once we came out of that period, interest rates have steadily fallen all the way, essentially, even in Europe, to negative range. That is a huge move. And that is a 40-year bull market in bonds that has protected and carried a lot of people. Now imagine if that starts to turn, which it is. How far it will go, I don't know. Some people say that you can't go very far up because all the sovereign governments will be wiped out. You know, I would say you can do that if that's your goal, if you want to wipe out sovereign governments. And it certainly looks to me like that's what Mr. Global wants to do. So we'll have to see where it is. But if you drive the U.S. dollar index up and you drive interest rates up, you're gonna bankrupt a lot of players. And whether they're countries or companies or individuals. So, you know, this was the wind in the sails, certainly of many parties who had access to the particularly low interest rates, and that includes sovereign governments. Now, this slaughtered savers. So if you were a saver and saved lots of money, you got slaughtered. Back here, you were sitting, you know, you could get 8% on a CD and have a nice life with no risk. Not so here, you're getting almost 0% on your CD. So a very important chart to understand because, you know, what life feels like going like this is very different than what life feels like going like this. Because I remember this. I lived through that and I remember this. So, you know, wind in your sails here, headwinds all the way up here. Okay. Now, of course, interest rates reprices everything from commodities to stocks to precious metals. Everything has a more expensive covering cost. Rambis is very bullish on commodities. He thinks we're into a new move. He's not ready to call a strong move up in gold yet. He wants to see more. Let me see if I can find how he describes this at the end. If the chartology plays out as expected, the second quarter of 2022. So what he's saying is we need more, we need to watch more sort of market action over the next quarter. But if it plays out, it should be something to behold for the precious metals complex. And for those of you that can ride the bull and not get bucked off, we could very well be in for the ride of a lifetime. All the best, Rambis. I agree. I think it's too early to tell, but gold and silver have the potential to begin the kind of ride that a lot of the gold bugs have been screaming about for 20 years, but it could finally happen. And part of it is the central banks are going to clearly use gold as a very significant holding at that. And gold's going to be a very significant holding at the wholesale level. So, as I said, fascinating. Piece from Rambis. Okay, so I want to turn to noteworthy developments. There are eight noteworthy developments that I want to discuss. Let me start with number one, inflation. Inflation is significant. Two of the websites I use to track real inflation, because official inflation and real inflation are very, very different. But two of the websites I use are Shadow Stats, John Williams. So John Williams was a very sort of mainstream economist. He started noticing that more and more crazy things were happening in the government statistics, and he started to dig into the numbers and rework them to see what was really going on. Anyway, inflation is one of the things he charts at his his website, Shadow Government Statistics. John, I'm a subscriber, but he has a lot of very valuable free material. He's been on the Salyer Report several times, and I really recommend his work. As you can see, the blue line is John's calculation of the consumer price index. So the red line is the official line, which is quite high, going through 8%. John has it well up here, probably at about 15%. This is 87 to 22. So you see in perspective, we're back. We're headed back into this period when Volcker jerked up the rates. So he has us, actually, he's got us above 15%, sort of at 17%. So that is, you know, that's not hyperinflation yet, but it's very strong. He also has a inflation calculator, which is fun to play with. So let's say you came out of college in 2008. And so we want to see what would hold you even if you were earning $100. Let's just put in $100,000. If you were earning $100,000 when you came out of college or graduate school in 2008, how much would you need in 2022 to hold even? You need $135,662 to hold even, according to the Shadow Stats calculations. You know, that's a significant, and if you look at what salaries and income have been inflating at, they certainly haven't matched that in for many, many people. Anyway, another one I love to look at, and many of you have heard me talk about this before, is the Chatwood Index. This is done by an investment advisor in Chicago who took the 50 most common household goods and just calculated how much they increased. He hasn't updated it since the first half of 2019. I assume he was pretty busy during the pandemic. But as you can see, the inflation rate has been, you know, if the official rates are saying it's over 8%, all of a sudden, no, it's been over 8% for a long time. And as I say, I used to travel tremendously by car in the United States. He does this for 50 metro areas. And one of the reasons I live in Memphis, let's see where Memphis is. Does he still have Memphis on the list? Yeah, Memphis. So the five-year average in Memphis is 9%. And it used to be one of the lowest. It's gone up a little bit more. But one of the reasons I live in Memphis and not in Silicon Valley is it's a significant difference. So in the first half of 2019, if you're in a place where the inflation is 12.1%, it's a big difference to being in a place where it's 8%. So Dallas is 8%. Anyway, so check out the Chatwood Index for your area if you live in the United States and your interest. The Shadow Stats also has some money supply charts, and they try and estimate what the M3 was. The Fed stopped publishing the M3 quite a while ago. But if you look at the money supplies, it doesn't matter whether you're looking at M2, M3, etc. What you're watching is the skyrocketing. You know, as soon as the going direct started, the printing press was off and running. And so, and this is part of the tension between the commodity producers, because if someone like the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve are simply just manufacturing money for free, and the London banks too, manufacturing dollars for free, they don't want to trade oil for dollars and have the dollars go down in value while the oil sitting in the ground is going up. And that's part of the tension. There's a great article that Lynn Alden just published on investing in a stagflation that gives you the history of sort of what the experience has been investing during an environment like this. Let me see if I can just pick it up. These links... And Lynn, I'm also a subscriber here. She does a lot public as well. And this is a very good overview to help you understand what this environment has been like historically. And she uses the example of Turkey to describe a society in an equity market dealing with significant inflation. Okay, so development two is is interest rates. And I've talked through the interest rates in the, wait a minute. So again, this chart is stronger with what the Fed did today. But here, if you look at the 10-year, or up here, if you look at the 30-year, we're talking about a very fast move up in interest rates. And that's going to have a dramatic change. So inflation up strongly, interest rates up strongly. And there's some real serious questions when interest rates rise this fast. What's it going to do to the derivative markets? What's it going to do to pull the plug on credit issues? What is it going to pull the plug on sovereign governments? What's the politics of that going to be? So this can be, politically, this can be a very tense time. And there are going to be a lot of players who borrowed in dollars and are going to be in that bear trap. Okay, third development is the risk of war. And this cannot be underestimated. Clearly, we have a war in Ukraine, and that war is dramatically increasing in cost. Anybody who watched the costs fly up on the Middle East war knows how expensive war can be. But one of the things I've realized as I've talked with subscribers and answered questions and asked Catherine is many of our subscribers are very financially sophisticated, and others have not spent a lot of time understanding or tracking the financial markets, and they don't understand the relationship between government policy, government regulations, government purchases, government contracts, and the stock market. And so with the events in the Ukraine happening and the administration first saying that they're going to send $3 billion of military aid, and suddenly overnight we see a report that the U.S. GDP is contracting, suddenly they're going to spend another $20 billion on weapons. And if you watch the media politicking the White House, you know, they're all lobbying for weapon sales. Everybody's, you know, the trough is out and people are sort of licking their chops. Anyway, because of what's been going on, if you look at we'll look at the stock charts, the defense contractors are definitely, those stocks are definitely moving up. So I wanted to give you a little example of how to estimate, and think of this as a case study. How would you estimate, how much a war adds to the stock market and of the companies involved? So we saw an article that we covered in Money Markets several weeks ago on 8 weapons manufacturers invited to the Pentagon to discuss the war in Ukraine. And we've listed those 8 contractors. They're essentially 8 of the top 10 defense contractors in the United States. The number one being Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin's gross contracts for the last year available are, I think, 2 or 3 times as many as the number two, which is Raytheon. So Lockheed Martin is formidable in terms of its position basically running the government, not just the Defense Department. They're the company who had the most payment in information systems, whereupon that helped disappear the $21 trillion. But they have tremendous amounts of contracts, including in the information and payment area around the government, very significant market share. And increase, I never forget when I was in Australia in 2018 being informed that Lockheed was taking over their defense information systems. So there's a lot of integration going on underneath the carpet, behind the scenes, through the systems and through these contractors. To give you a sense of relative values, Apple is now worth essentially $2 trillion. Lockheed Martin's market cap is only 118. So if you go across this chart, you see Lockheed Martin, the name of the contractors, or the including weapons manufacturers, but defense firms, where their headquarters is. Everybody's an American company except for BAE Systems, which is a major UK defense firm. Then we have their market cap, which is the amount of their outstanding stock value. Now, what we did was we went and took a look at their federal revenue contracts In the last year you could get their contracts, which was 2019 or 2020, what was the percent of their federal contracts as a percent of their total revenues? And as you can see, it's a major number, except for BAE Systems, but that number of 28% is only the U.S. defense. I'm sure if we added the U.K. defense, it would be a much higher number. And what you can see is many of these companies are basically serving the U.S. government. Boeing has a big commercial business that's been rocky. So they're I would say they're, of all of these, they have the, they and Raytheon have the lowest. If you look at the total percent of the defense contract and purchase pie, Lockheed has about 17%. So the A column is what's the percent of the total contract pie that they're getting in the last available year. So Lockheed is 17%. It scales down to L3Harris, which has about 1.5%. So that's their market share of total defense pies in the last year. We said, okay, let's just assume if the administration puts out what is now $23.6 billion in aid to Ukraine, let's just assume that their percent of the pie is the same as their last year of defense contractors. You know, I suspect it's very different than that because Lockheed, Raytheon are doing more than most here, but it's a conservative assumption. We'll just use it. And then if we said, okay, well, that would produce the following amounts from $4.2 billion for Lockheed all the way down to $352 million for L3Harris. If we said, okay, we'll assume on this book of business that their operating margin is the same as their last operating market margin shown in their annual wrap-up or annual report, usually in a war situation, the margins are much higher. We even heard rumors on Afghanistan, that the margins were as high as 50%. But let's just assume they're the same as in the overall. And I think on Boeing, we used just the percent that was in their government business because they've had some real problems on the commercial side. And so we estimated what would their pro forma operating profit be under those estimations, you know, big assumptions here. How much would their profits be? And then at their price earnings ratio on their stock, how much value would it add to their market capitalization? And as you can see, I'll use Lockheed. Lockheed's market capitalization would go up $12.6 billion. That's a lot of profits for investors. And that's a major injection into the stock market. One of my favorite quotes is Jack Ma saying, when trade stops, war starts. And, the stocks that were making money on trading with Russia and China and the BRIC nations are now going to start, you know, we're now going to see the enforcers stock trade up. Okay, if you look at the annual proxy for all these companies and you say, okay, who are the large shareholders who have more than 5%? What you see is our old friends, BlackRock and Vanguard, the big index companies. You also see State Street, which is some passive investment, but also sometimes represents their retirement funds, company employee ownership. And so what you can see is major big institutional holdings. And in one sense, the profits on the Ukraine translate into significant value that then flow into all the index funds managed by by BlackRock. And BlackRock's the black one in the front, Vanguard's red, and State Street's blue, and then a variety of other institutional investors in there. But it's her old friend BlackRock and Vanguard and the index funds. And I dare say, for many of the people listening to this, if you have a 401k or retirement fund and you're doing index funds, good chance you're in BlackRock and Vanguard. If you go to Open Secret's website and look at the political contributions by industry, what you'll find is defense is relatively minor in terms of the amount they give. And one of the reasons is they have many, many other ways of generating massive political support, like placing employment around the country. And I think they tend to be pretty careful about overt contributions. They can also pay lobbyists and law firms who make contributions, but there's no doubt that their contributions have kicked up recently. If you look at a more recent Lockheed, you'll see 2.5+ million. Okay, so let's. How does that translate into the S&P? On these two, we're looking at two charts of the defense contractors versus the S&P. And we broke it into two charts because we're looking at eight firms. And in each one, we have the S&P. And here you can see, here's the blue line from 1995 on. Here's the S&P down here. BAE Systems is sort of half of the S&P. And here's Lockheed Martin. And you can see coming out of the financial crisis, skyrocketing. And here's where the Ukraine squabble starts, skyrocketing. So, and the time I really noticed the skyrocketing, and you won't notice here, is the defense stocks started taking up a much bigger portion of the market income after 9/11. So progressively, you've seen, as we move to central control, more and more high performance from the defense stocks. Now, if you look at this chart, some of them are underperforming the S&P. So, you know, but actually not by much. Let's go look at the, yeah, so here's Raytheon, and down here's the S&P. So it's quite astonishing how well they've done since 1995. And that's sort of when the decision was made to do the coup. And it's right here at October 1997 that the money started to disappear. And it wouldn't surprise me if that, the missing money in FASB 56 and these kind of classification laws were essential, because if there's anybody who runs the Lockheed, the secret operations in America, it's some of these guys, Lockheed, Raytheon, General Dynamics. Okay, this is simply 2022. So this is year to date. So the charts we were looking at was 1995 to date. This is Lockheed Martin and Boeing and BAE and General Dynamics for the year. And so what you can see is the S&P moving down to, you know, minus 12%. Boeing has had problems with, on the commercial side, and they're clearly getting hurt. And of course, Lockheed, I would say Lockheed rising in a pattern in January, February. So, you know, clearly somebody knew the war was coming. You know, the prices, rigged as they may be, don't lie. Here again, we see the S&P down 12 and this other group, which is Raytheon and some of the others. Now, when the administration announced another $20 billion, we'll see how that plays out. I think the market wanted to see whether it was finally appropriated or not. But I would expect this trend to continue, and that's not good. Again, when trade stops, war starts, and this kind of expense is not going to, I think, is not going to be good for the general economy. But what you see is, you've seen in the White House press conferences incredible, you know, just all the media is just paid to generate weapon sales. it's quite amazing. And then, in the commentary at Saleri Report, here I put, let me just show you, beneath the chart that shows the relationship between the Fed pumping and the S&P going up, I put a little video that Matt Taibbi and some of his crew came up with. Let me show you this. Let's see if this will play.
The US deliver the heavy weapons? The U.S. has contributed, I think, nearly $2 billion in aid, militarily, economic, since this war began. Can the U.S. be doing more?
The most important thing right now is the weapons, weapon systems, the weapons they need. They need to have Stingers and the Javelins, but they also need anti-aircraft capabilities. They need anti-missile capabilities. They need anti-tank capabilities. There's a lot of weapon systems, the weapons they need. We have to bring these weapons to get the weapons to the Ukrainians, move these weapon systems, to deliver those weapon systems, make sure that the Ukrainians are getting the weapons with anti-missile capabilities, Patriot missiles, the S-300s, the S-400s, weapon systems. Additional aircraft, as many weapons as necessary to provide weapons, sophisticated weapons, whatever possible weapons can be provided.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. He works at a firm whose clients include Raytheon, the second largest military contractors in the world.
The most important thing right now is the weapons.
We should arm the Ukrainians.
Providing weapons, providing supplies, fences to arm weapons with ammunition.
We have to simply do more. To do something more.
To do more, we will have to do more. More direct involvement of some kind will be inevitable. More arms, more and more. More and more pressure for us to do more and more by way of supplying weapons, arms.
Undisclosed conflict of interest. He's on the board of directors at Lockheed Martin.
Anyway, you can watch the video. It's in the commentary, but kind of says it all. Anyway, so it's very important as you watch what's going on to understand how the money works. Whenever somebody gets a job at a publicly traded corporation, I always get them to read all the SEC documents on how the money works at the corporation and watch the behavior of the board and management as it relates to what's happening in the stock market that's affecting their stock prices. Remember, you know, a way a lot of the senior people make big money, and some of the employees too, is on the stock going up. So, you know, it creates an incentive system. I used to be shocked when I was FHA commissioner because, you know, everybody would basically lobby me to do whatever I could do that would make their stock go up. And it had nothing, you know, there was no thought of policy whatsoever. It was just, you know, weapon sales or the mortgage equivalent of weapon sales. Okay, so development number three is the risk of war and the need, the use of pouring money into war to keep the economy going and keep the stock market up. Okay, development number four, engineering demand destruction. I think we are looking at many different events that generate demand destruction. Climate change, the COVID-19 op was about demand destruction. The Great Poisoning was about demand destruction. Lowering the life expectancy is about demand destruction. War is about demand destruction. We're watching multiple things going on trying to engineer demand destruction. The grid is about significantly lowering people's economic freedom and economic footprint to bring about demand destruction. And when you're printing this kind of loose monetary policy, you need deflation. And one of the ways you do that is with demand destruction. And it's a form of economic warfare. And I think it's far, far from over. Interestingly enough, we've seen a lot of problems with filling jobs. And I think part of it is the mandates and vaccine deaths and adverse events have caused a lot of the resignations to happen. And that's inflationary in the short run. But if you look at how what I call the great poisoning is going to continue, I think it's going to be phenomenally deflationary in terms of sort of lowering demand destruction. And the unemployment or the inability to find employment will be used to justify massive automation, which is coming one way or another. Development number five is the multipolar world and multipolar markets. As you watch the political tensions between Russia, China, and the BRIC nations and the Anglo-American Empire and the G7, you're seeing a real bifurcation in the markets. We could literally see Chinese companies stop financing in the American markets or in the West. We've seen Russian stocks basically, it's a forced devaluation and very, very painful if you had a good Russian stock. So we're watching a destruction of liquidity for political reasons and a split in the market which to me is a very, very sad thing to do because, you know, I'm back to Jack Ma. When trades, you know, when trade stops, war starts. And having each other invested in each other's equity markets and pools of capital is what keeps trade going and stops wars. And I would hate to see the day, I would hate to wake up and find that all the Chinese ADRs had lost their ADR status and were simply trading in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Shanghai. I would hate to see that, but it could happen. And it's one thing to keep about. I just approved a really amazing Chinese stock for our screen today. And the person I was working with said, what do you think the risks are? And I said, the risks are that they're not committed to maintaining an ADR. That's the risk. Development number six is crypto adaptation and developments. Fidelity has just announced that they're going to permit Bitcoin investment through their 401k plans. And this is amazing because the Department of Labor came out, did a guidance on Bitcoin, but didn't say you can't do it. Fidelity took the position that they were then okay to do it. And now we're getting articles saying the Department of Labor is angry that they're doing it and something could happen. Anyway, to me, this is pretty simple. If bonds are going down and they're $123 trillion market, it takes a lot of money to hold that market up if you're rigging things. You just can't afford to do it, and or it'd be phenomenally expensive. And you've got $105 trillion stock market. That's expensive to hold up. But Bitcoin's only $750 billion. And it's not that liquid, so it's really easy to run that up. So if you're trying to get a portfolio to hold its value, it's much easier to get a portfolio to hold its value by running up Bitcoin than trying to prop up the stock or bond market, certainly the bond market. So it looks to me, I hate to say this, like the next big Bitcoin pump may be coming too. Certainly if I was trying to get money out of a bond market, where would I want it to go? I wouldn't want it to go to real assets because that's really inflationary. You know, part of the problem we're having in real estate is all that money is pouring in. So why wouldn't you prefer for it to run up crypto? Makes perfect sense to me. So I've always said I think there's more pumping to be done. And if you look at what Fidelity's up to, I think this is a very important signal that there's a reasonably good chance of a very bullish pump on Bitcoin. Development number seven is the inability to integrate. And I've talked about this many times, but it's phenomenal after everything that's happened in the COVID-19 op, I'll just call it an op because that's what it was, that we're still looking at an entire industry in the financial world that cannot incorporate or integrate, you know, half of the economy, which is covert. It's FASB 56. It's the missing money. It's the black budget. It's all these different things. And it's very frustrating for many subscribers and people in our audience because they're constantly saying, I can't find an investment advisor who understands how the world works. And it's funny because I subscribe to a number of different services of people who I think are really smart and really excellent, but they won't touch it. They won't go there. And I'll never forget listening to one interview by two people who I have tremendous respect for. I think they're very good. I'm a subscriber to one. I listen to the other. And I was driving about an hour north to an appointment here in the Netherlands. And it was so frustrating to hear them pretend, you know, that literally half of the economy isn't there and isn't happening. I was just screaming because they're so talented. And I remember saying to one colleague, why is it they refuse to deal with reality? And they said, they just can't handle it. They feel like they'll be overwhelmed if they try. And I said, okay. But it makes it very, very difficult for people who do understand what's going on in this world to talk to a financial person because they're just not integrating the knowledge they need to create a comprehensive picture of what's happening and what it means to your investments. Now, the reality is, you know, forget the black budget for a second. If you talk about what Rambis is saying, he never mentions the covert side. But if you look at what he talks about, I pretty much align with him perfectly in terms of what different asset classes are going to do and where they're going to go. So, you know, somebody doesn't have to talk about that stuff or integrate it. You certainly can't integrate it in technical analysis. But I would say it makes it very frustrating, I think, for people who do understand what's going on and try to understand what's going on to talk to a lot of financial people, because they either won't look at it or they don't feel it safe to discuss for regulatory or sort of marketing reasons. At the same time, we have a variety of corporate players and government leaders embracing what I call Schwabville and Bizarro World. It's so strange. I mean, it's strange to walk around the world and see people treat Klaus Schwab in an obsequious manner when he's basically proposing communism and the end of all capital markets and all financial markets and the destruction of family wealth, while your investment advisor is pretending everything's fine and you should just put more money in Lockheed because, after all, it's, you know, going to the moon. Anyway, so there's definitely a deterioration of mind and a deterioration of reality paradigms and a failure to integrate. And I think it's very frustrating. And if you're feeling frustrated about it, I just tell you, you know, you're feeling frustrated because you have every right to feel frustrated. I've been feeling frustrated about it my whole life, but it is what it is. Finally, development number 8 is SPACs. If you go to the, I had this up, but let me go there again. If you go, SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company. And essentially, a group of investors put money in what's a blind pool. It's a group of managers who say, give us your money and we're going to go out and buy a company with your money. And so you put the money, it's basically blind, and then they go out and hopefully find a company, or they don't. And when they find a company, they tell you, okay, now we found a company named ABC and we're going to buy it. And you have the right to take your money back and say, well, that's not what I want my money in. Anyway, so one of the reasons we looked at SPACs is if you look at SPAC Analytics, which is one of the websites that follows SPACs, we start out in 2003 with one IPO in SPACs. And, you know, we kind of turtle along. We go to 66 in 2007. And we just turtle along. We get all the way up to 59 in 2019. And then suddenly in 2020, remember, going direct reset is approved August 2019. FASB 56 is approved 2018. So now we have a geyser of secret money, supposedly, and we have the going direct approved by the G7 central bankers. All of a sudden, SPAC volume rises 5 times by 500%, and then another 300% all during COVID. And as soon as COVID is over, boom, back down. And it looks like, this is 2020. This is 22 so far, but it looks like it's, you know, going to be a significantly lower year. So SPACs just happened to coincide with going direct reset and the COVID-19 up. And let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, that does not look like a coincidence. So Carolyn Betts and I decided to dig in and see what's going on. And part of this is an opportunity for me to have a discussion about how, if you remember the old Pillsbury Doughboy commercials, how you squeeze down on one place and it pops out another. So how does the Fed print here and suddenly, you know, there's 1,000 blind pools happening in the marketplace? How does the money get from one place to another? So it's a conversation I want to have. Anyway, so development number 8, the final of our 8 developments, is SPAC, and SPACs will be looking at that in 2 weeks with attorney Carolyn Betts. Okay, so that's our title for the theme, SPACs, investment craze or reset laundry, as in going direct reset. Okay, let me move to the last part, review of allocations. The question is, where in this environment, sort of in a new and more bizarre stagflation, where do you put your money? I've said a lot about this in the last four equity overviews, and so I don't want to repeat a lot of what I've said before, but let me just quick run through allocations, and I'm going to use my allocations. People will tell you don't put money in cash because cash is going down in value. Its purchasing power is getting lost. I don't necessarily feel that way. I think it's important to have a reserve fund, something for a rainy day, and a way to protect your way out of a corner. So real estate can be going gangbusters, but your jurisdiction can put you in a tax squeeze or a maintenance squeeze or some kind of regulatory squeeze. And if you don't have cash and credit, you can get yourself in trouble. Now, if you have plenty of credit and you can always get a loan at the bank, great. But I find in certain scenarios, cash is king. And I don't mind having a whole pile of cash when, even though the value of cash is going down. And I think there's tremendous savings to be garnered by using cash to pay for things, not just the privacy, but the kind of discounts and deals and relationships you can get with local business if you're doing business in cash. Fixed income, I'm just not a fan of fixed income in this market. If you do any fixed income, you want the highest possible credit quality. I'm also not a fan of annuities because I've always found you can do better by doing bonds and controlling the credit on your own and controlling your money on your own. But if you do annuities, you want the highest possible credit quality. And what you'll see is there's tremendous divergence between an annuity with a really strong credit versus one that doesn't have it. So, and it's very tempting, I think, for people to take one that doesn't have that credit quality. Equities. I'm not a fan of index funds for a variety of reasons. When index funds started, and Jack Bogle at Vanguard, the guy who really got them going, said this. He said, we're free riding the analyst community. The analysts are doing all the due diligence and making sure that everybody stays clean, and they're watching the store, and we're just free riding them. And once we destroy the economics of the analysts and they go away, that's when the problems start. Now, if you look at all the analysis on index funds, there's a tremendous argument because you get the lowest possible fees. And the one thing you can always do for yourself long run is to pay the lead. Fees can eat up a lot over a long period of time. And that's the strong argument. The other strong argument is we're watching an equity market where there's dramatic changes within the different sectors, growth stocks getting killed, value stocks finally coming back up. Historically, value stocks have always done better in the long run than growth, but we've been in a period where value stocks have significantly underperformed the market, and value has, it's so funny because I just remember so many people saying, will value ever come back? But it certainly looks like it's coming back right now. Let me just pull this up. This is a really good piece from Visual Capitalist. It's from the Advisor Channel. Rising rates, why value stocks have outperformed. And it has a very good, and again, the links will be in the subscriber links, has a very good overview of value versus growth over long periods of time. So as you can see, we've been in a period where growth has just killed value. And so here's the dot-com bubble, growth doing very well, bam, that collapses, value doing well. But then we came out of the financial crisis, and it's just growth, growth, growth. And but here it shows since the 40s, values outperformed. So anyway, the question is, will they? Anyway, so I like value stocks. Value stocks can look a lot more boring, but you're talking about enduring companies that can, that can handle the inflationary environment. They have the muscle, and they have the ability to generate cash. So anyway, take a look at this. It's the Advisor Channel, and it's from Visual capitalist infographics. Anyway, so I've always liked value stocks, and I still like value stocks. There's a lot of the growth stocks that I haven't trusted. I think they have they have received a lot of the wrong kind of support, because they're helping to build the smart grid and they're helping to build control. And as a result, they get a lot of subsidy, but it's not real economic endurance and real economic clout. So one of the things I like about value is that you end up getting more dividends. And this is the kind of market, if you look at the Lynn Alden piece on investing during a stagflation, you get a lot on the, sort of the benefit of dividends versus gains. I'm fully hedged. I don't have a lot in the equity markets, but, I tend to keep my money in my business, but everything I've got in the equity markets is hedged, and it's going to be hedged, and it's in stock. I know every stock. You know, I know the stock. I know what's good about it. I know why I own it. And I can't tell you, it's very important for me to open up a portfolio and see what are the stocks I own and understanding why I own them, and making sure they're companies that I believe are very productive. And, you know, they provide some useful function, and they have real serious economic endurance. I tend to stay away from companies that do a lot of business with the government. I don't want a political stock. I want a stock that's got real economic endurance and real serious productivity. And I can't tell you how important it is in this environment, one, to put your money into institutions, companies, management that have real integrity. Nobody's perfect. It's a, you know, business is an art, not a science. And it's impossible to be perfect, but I just think integrity matters, and whether it's the credit in the bond market or quality in the stock market or in any activity that you do, whether it's your bank, whether it's private companies you invest in, whether it's your own business and the vendors you deal with, you've got to look for the kind of quality that can handle the friction and the endurance. And to me, that takes real integrity. Real estate and land. I'm very concerned with inflation, that people will get shut out of ownership of real estate and land, and that's part of what's being engineered with the pumping of the money and siphoning it to investors who are basically buying up real estate and throwing renters out. There's a great new video by True Stream Media. It's in our Telegram channel, and we'll have it in the Money and Markets link for this week, on the housing crisis in the United States. I think it's happening in many, many places. And I would encourage you, even though it's not the most cheerful video, I would encourage you to watch it. If there's any way you're not, if you don't have a land or home of your own, if you can get one, do. Many people think, oh, it's an inflationary environment, so I'm going to buy the biggest thing I can do it. Don't do that. You know, I bought the tiniest. I knew this was coming, and I bought the tiniest because I wanted to make sure, no matter how bad things got, if they tripled my taxes, my property taxes, I'd be just fine. And until recently, my property taxes for three properties in Hickory Valley had a combined city and county tax bill of $500 a year. I just snuck over $500. So there it is. I would say this is a very high friction environment, and it's an environment where many things can go wrong and people can get hiccuped. In all the ways we talk about in the Salieri Report, please do a time budget. Your most precious asset is your time. And do a time budget, do a sources and uses of time, and be ruthless and cut out anything that's draining you. Cut out people that are draining you. You have to get really ruthless about your time. Jurisdictions. Get in the best when you can. I can't tell you how many people I know who've moved jurisdictions or are looking to move jurisdictions because they realize, oh, you know, if you have a governor like the governor of South Dakota and the governor of Florida, it's very different than if you have a governor like the governor of New York and California. So get the best jurisdiction you can. And the reality is, I built my life to anticipate that I might have to move multiple occasions because, in a war, movement is life. great line from Brad Pitt in World War Z, movement is life. Food and health, the greatest threat to your financial situation is the great poisoning and what it could do to your health. So you have to be really, really savvy about health. And I want to conclude with a story because food and health and finances are all part of one thing. In other words, you get the food and health wrong and your finances are going to go. You get the finances wrong and your health could go. So it's, you know, it's one of those environments where we have to be good at both. Anyway, I want to end with a story that Chris Powell from Gattaca used to always tell. I loved it when he'd use it in his speeches because I think it's so funny. Because so many of us live in a world where in our family, you know, one guy's interested in the finance, one guy's interested in the health. You know, often it's the wife that's interested in health, the husband is interested in money, and they're not quite understanding, wait a minute, it's one thing. But this tells the story of, you know, of that split, and I think it's very funny. It's about Groucho Marx, supposed to be a true story. Groucho Marx made a small fortune in vaudeville and then lost it all in the stock market crash of 1929. His sense of humor was no help to him then. One day in the early 1930s, he was sitting in a bar with his friend Maury, and Maury was trying to console him. Yes, Maury told Groucho, we've lost a lot of money and it hurts, but we've still got our health and our lives ahead of us, and some people don't even have that. Take my cousin Fred. He's much worse off than we are, but he's pressing on as best he can. Fred lost his leg to a carriage accident when he was 5. His parents were killed in a tenement fire when he was 12. His wife ran off with his best friend when he was 27, and then he had diabetes at 29. Groucho was not to be consoled. He had lost too much money in the crash. He snarled back at Maury, diabetes at 29? That's nothing. I had radio at 104. That's a man who doesn't appreciate the importance of health to his finances. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be back in 2 weeks with attorney Carolyn Betts. We'll talk about SPACs. And that will round up the first quarter wrap-up. And until then, again, check out all the materials and the links in the first section. There's if you go back through all the different equity overviews, and let me just show you that chart again. See, if you go back through all the equity overviews, particularly the one with the annual wrap-up with Rambus, and then you check out the links, these subscriber links that we did with the first quarter wrap-up, I think you'll find a wealth of information. And of course, if you have questions, you can always post them in the commentary for this wrap-up. Here it is. And again, take a look at the web presentation. You can post them here or send them to Ask Catherine. So all I can tell you is it's an environment, we're coming into major paradigm shifts. We're in major paradigm shifts. And, you know, don't get frozen in fear. There is always, with this kind of change, there is always incredible opportunity to make a difference. So I wish you good hunting and let us have your questions and know how we can help. So, ladies and gentlemen, good hunting and good night and good luck.